Well, hello, everyone. I'm Thompson Howell, host of the LA AGO podcast. Here we are, launching into 2022. I start off with an apology for not getting an episode out last month in December. There were some scheduling issues, some logistical issues, and some technical issues. Our lovely neighbor next door hired a tree service and they snipped my internet cable. So I had to run a new internet cable from the home office in the house out here to my home studio where I do most of my work, which is 30, 40 feet. And I had to string new Ethernet cables so I could get the high-speed internet back out here. So we got that accomplished and we are back and off and running. By the time I get this episode out and published, we will have gone through the holiday season. I hope you enjoyed your holidays and celebrated whatever way you wish to. And if you live here in Los Angeles, you know we've had to deal with a ton of rain the last couple of weeks, which is a good thing in the big picture. We'll see how it affects the overall drought situation. And even today, we're talking on the 30th of December, and it's gently raining outside my studio right now, so you might hear some of that in the background. Welcome in. We're in 2022, and our next event is coming up Monday, January the 17th, 8 o'clock, from Herrick Chapel in the lovely campus of Occidental College in the Eagle Rock neighborhood of Los Angeles. Tyrone Whiting is going to be recitalizing for us. Tyrone is London-born and bred, a organist, conductor, pianist, and teacher. He'll be giving that recital Monday the 17th at 8 o'clock from Herrick Chapel. And on the Saturday prior to that, on Saturday, January 15th, he'll be doing a masterclass for us, also at Herrick Chapel on the Schlicker organ there. And so this is a great opportunity to come out and learn a lot from him. And who knows, maybe he'll learn something too in the process of teaching. That's always a great thing to see how people learn from each other in an environment like that. So the masterclass, Saturday the 15th, and the recital by Tyrone Whiting on Monday the 17th at 8 o'clock. All the details will be found on the chapter website at laheo.org or in the most recent newsletter, e-newsletter, which by the time I get this out, might already be in your inbox. So look for that. Specific details about both those events, including COVID-related guidelines and other logistical issues. So we're looking forward to that. Tyrone Whiting from London. He did his undergraduate degree work at the Trinity Laban Conservatoire of Music and Dance. He did a postgraduate diploma in performance science. I want to know what that's about. I don't think about science and performing in the same thought. We'll talk about that. He went. That was at the Royal College of Music. He returned to the RCM in 2016. He fast-tracked his Master of Music degree in organ performance and won the Harold Dark Prize in 2017. He's performed at venues across the UK, Europe, and the United States, and that list of concerts is growing as we speak. And currently, he is pretty much, I think, the brand spanking new director of music at the historic St. Martin in the Fields Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And Tyrone joins us now from his home in Philadelphia. Tyrone, hello.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for making the time during this lull between Christmas and New Year's. How were your holidays?
Very quiet, deliberately quiet. Although our services were quieter than I would have liked, as we had to cut back to a quartet rather than a full choir due to the current health crisis.
Yeah.
But full of good music still, and then deliberately not after December 25th.
Right. We were the same way here, and a lot of churches were the same way here. The rise of the Omicron variant of COVID sort of subdued things a little bit. I'm interested to see what January is going to bring and see how things go. So hopefully things don't get any worse. But, you know, we'll see what kind of plans have to be made and what restrictions, if any, need to be made. But it's good to hear that you're starting off well at St. Martin in the Fields. How are you finding, you and your husband, Sean, how are you finding Philadelphia?
We're loving it. It's already been almost a year since I started at St. Martin in the Fields. It was January 19th. But I still feel both brand new and sort of established here already. So it's kind of a wonderful dichotomy of feeling.
Yeah.
Philly is a great city. It has its great parts. It has its slightly not so great parts. And Gritty is a perfect mascot for Philly.
Every city has that, the good, the bad. LA, the same. And I grew up in Boston and lived in Chicago, and every city's got its good stuff and the stuff we'd rather not talk about. Although traffic, we're a little delayed in getting started today because you were stuck in traffic in Philadelphia.
Traffic in Philadelphia is just a nightmare.
Where was everyone going or coming from?
I'm not sure, but they were not in a rush.
Post-holiday shopping, maybe, trying to take advantage of some of the post-Christmas sales or something. Well, every city I've ever lived in is, everyone's complained about the traffic in to one degree or another. So anyway, we're glad you're here now. And we're looking forward to seeing you, like I said, on January the 17th, Monday at 8 o'clock at Herrick Chapel. A fabulous acoustic and the Schlicker organ there, perfect match, I think. And you're going to enjoy learning more about that organ, and we're going to enjoy hearing you play it. And the masterclass, like I said, on the 15th of January on Saturday. St. Martin in the Fields, you've been there a while. You had a job, I think, in Newark just before, prior to that one?
Correct.
Is that your first adventures over here in the States, or what brought you to the States? Did the job bring you to the States, or were going to come anyway?
My own curiosity, really. I knew I always wanted to work or live, work or study in the United States from a very early age. And so in 2016, I actually auditioned for grad school over here, decided it wasn't the right time to move, which is why I ended up doing the master's program at the Royal College of Music. And then the job at New Jersey came up, a wonderful, historic Anglo-Catholic parish church, great Casavant organ, wonderful acoustic, in Newark, New Jersey. Not the first place I thought I would end up in the United States, but I'm really glad I did. It was a challenge of a city, but a really, really wonderful place to be. And so, yeah, I moved for the job and spent a good 2.5 years there, just until the pandemic.
And then things changed for all of us. And then the opportunity at St. Martin's came up. What was it about the St. Martin in the Fields opening that was appealing to you? And what are they trying to accomplish? And what do you bring to the table to help them do that?
Wow, good questions. what did the job have for me? Initially, it reminded me of being back in London a lot. It reminded me a lot of the setup that I left in my last job at St. Mary's Battersea in London. Very good volunteer choir, section leaders per section, and a great organ, a wonderful campus that we have here at St. Martin's. And the staff team is just phenomenal. The amount of things that team does in any given week is amazing. Social justice work, outreach work, youth and families work, and then there's the music program. It's really quite a special place. It's a little out of the city. We're still in the limits of Philadelphia, but we're encouraging people to come up to Chestnut Hill and hear us.
I checked out as part of doing my, whatever research I'm able to do before talking to someone. I checked out the church's website, and it looks like a lovely place, and active and seeking. It seems like they're trying to grow certain areas of their ministries, including parts of the music program. What's sort of your mandate, whether it's self-imposed or on direction? What are you trying to accomplish there? What exists there now, and how are you trying to grow things?
So we have a really capable and wonderful choir of about 24, 26 volunteer singers, plus 4 section leaders, and just myself as organist and director of music. We also have, the church has historically had a children's choir program that suffered through the pandemic, especially with children being such vectors for the coronavirus.
Yeah.
So it's now in the process of being basically restarted from scratch. We went from 2 children to 10 in the last 4 months, which has been wonderful.
That sounds pretty good. Pretty good, yeah.
Thank you.
Growth. Yeah.
The importance of teaching and education in my career is really important to me. It's really interesting in the opening how you said that I would learn something from the participants. I really hope so.
Yeah.
That is so vital to not only them being exposed to seeing someone who knows stuff, in inverted commas, learning from them, but knowing that they're able to pass on knowledge at whatever stage they are at in their development is really important. There's nothing better than seeing the smile on a child's face when they realize they can do something today that they couldn't do yesterday.
Yeah.
That's just awesome. So the children's part and the youth part is a big part of my work going forward. And I'm really excited by that. The other is just getting out of our postcode or our zip code, as you call it in this country. So getting the church's music program in line with everything else, in line with our social justice work, in line with our outreach work, so that we are at the forefront of this. We're a really fortunate church that's at the forefront of many facets of this, and there's no excuse for our music program not to be. So, for example, in February 27th, we'll be hosting, fingers crossed, pandemic allowing, a Black History Month concert, where we'll be inviting a local BIPOC clergy to speak at the event and read poetry and such, interspersed with music performed by our predominantly white choir. And there are eyebrows raised at that sometimes, I think that's one of the strengths that I can bring to St. Martin's is inclusion in our music programs, in that I am a non-white, homosexual classical musician in 2021, soon 2022. That's not the most common thing people experience in their day-to-day life. And that's kind of exciting for me when I get asked what I do, especially here in Philadelphia.
You mentioned the all-white choir or mostly white choir singing historically Black music, if you will. Is there a pushback from that sometimes? Accusations of cultural appropriation or anything like that? Sometimes.
Oh, this is such a deep topic that I'm fascinated by.
I don't want to go too deep.
No, that's all right. The issues of race.
I like putting things out there, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I understand it's a tricky topic, but there it is.
I think it's a really interesting thing to try and present historically Black music or music from underrepresented populations and people, that to make it not seem like a tokenism, you have to program it like it's not a tokenism. So you don't program Beethoven 9 and then something by Florence Price.
Right.
Because that will seem like a tokenism.
We had to throw it in there. Yeah,
yeah, exactly right. So I think it can be done extremely well. And actually, the Philadelphia Cathedral here are hosting an event at the end of January, which is about being able to sing the spirituals with integrity. And that's fascinating. I mean, insisting that as much of my choir can go to that event as possible so that they can understand the sort of context behind why we are doing this in 2022.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I wish you all the best of luck with that. So I usually ask every guest some variation of the same question. What's your organ origin story? You know, how did you first... since we are the LAAGO, American Guild of Organists, we sort of focus on the organ, although you obviously are a very versatile musician and have interests in many different things. But what was the lure for you to the organ? When did you first, that light bulb go off for you? It could have been a moment, could have been a specific place when you realized you wanted to really learn more about the organ and move forward in your learning.
For me, the first day I heard an organ, I wish I knew the date specifically, but I was about 14 or 15. And I just started at a very good private school in London. And I walked into the school hall and heard this organ. And having been a pianist and just having started the violin, which did not go much further than the end of high school, I knew that I had some keyboard skills. And I very cheekily went up to who I now know was the school organist and said, "Can I have a go, please?" And that was it. This the capability to produce so many different sounds out of my 10 then very unable fingers was fascinating. And I was instantly hooked.
When I was a choir kid, that was sort of what locked me in was that sound and trying to reverse engineer it. How do I make that sound and playing around? And like you, I was given the opportunity to do that. And it sounds like you had someone who recognized your interest and helped you to guide you along as you went along.
Absolutely. And I think that's why I kind of have this attitude of paying it forward, and the importance of outreach and education is there because someone did that for me when I was young. My route into the organ and choral world is not traditional. I was not a chorister. My family did not go to church. It was purely for the music. And now in my role where it's making music to the glory of God in God's buildings and for God's people, that puts a really different context on what that 14-year-old was experiencing. Mm-hmm. It's a really fascinating journey that was not as linear as most people expect their sort of music training to be.
It's funny you mentioned, you know, the music sort of lured you in and your family. And I would say that too. And I do a lot of church work. And I really do the church work because I love the music. And this may not be the right thing to say, but sometimes the other stuff, the theology and all that is less important. And I, you know, it's not unimportant, but it's, I guess, if I have a connection with God, it's through the music and not through any of the other avenues that you might experience in a liturgical setting.
I think that's one of the important things when it comes to making liturgical music. It's one piece might speak to you so well, and that might happen to be ascribed to the Lord or the sort of traditional Handel Messiah, St. John Passion, things like that.
Yeah.
I always tell my choirs and any singers I'm working with, actually the pieces that people are probably going to come up to you for at the end of the funeral or wedding you've just played for is the Pachelbel's Canon, or it's the Rutter, Lord Bless You and Keep You, because it's memorable. And that's for them, their connection. And so I think as a musician, if you can move one person in that space with what you do at any one time, job done.
Yeah. Well done. Well done. Let's talk about, you mentioned, when I went to your website originally and checked that out, you really emphasize it, and you have in other places as well, including some of the communication you and I have had over the past week or two, some emails, the importance of teaching to you, and not just teaching, but learning. And you did this diploma in performance science. What exactly does that mean? Because when I read that, that sounds a bit heady, intellectual, or something that should be a creative endeavor, and it just sort of not just happens, but talk about performance science. What is that, and how does that impact your work?
Sure. So it impacts every musician, whether they know about it or not. The psychology and physiology behind how we play, how we memorize, how we learn is there, whether you know about it or not. It's happening in real time. There's a wonderful thing your eyes do. This is the example I always go to. That first moment when you flick your eyes towards a clock, that first second seems to last slightly longer than the ensuing seconds afterwards. And that's because your brain does this really cool thing called saccadic masking, where it will take the time it took for your eyes to move from one fixation to the clock and add it to the image it next fixates on. So technically, your brain does see that second for slightly longer. Why does that help us? If you move your eyes around when you sight read and have these various fixation points, you're going to, inverted commas, see them for longer. It's going to help you. So when we teach people to move your eyes around when we sight read, often that's where the explanation stops. But it's much more fascinating to say, because your eyes work like this and your brain's going to understand it this way. And that's just one example of something the brain does that we don't really give it credit for. When we move our eyes, we do not see the move.
Yeah, we absorb, at least my experience is, and you can obviously explain it more, perhaps more technically, if I'm sight reading something or something I know but I haven't memorized, I'm always slightly reading ahead, mm-hmm. you know, just a little, a measure or two, just sort of what's coming, so I know what's coming. Mm-hmm. And I assume my brain is, while I'm playing a measure or two back, my brain is already absorbing the information I'm going to have to play.
That is called the hand-eye gap, I believe, if I remember that correctly. Where your eyes are fixating and where your hands are playing currently is called the hand-eye gap. And it occurs in other examples of things. Pilots, for example, are taught how to scan a screen. You never scan your windscreen left to right in a very linear way. You actually dart your eyes around because it's more effective. Mm. So actually darting your eyes around the score is more effective than sort of linear progressions. Circles, somewhere in the middle. Anyway, that's a lot of technical detail that I'll expose the kids to in the masterclass.
Yeah, I was going to say, how does that impact your actual teaching student? But I think this is a great opportunity to say, come to the masterclass and see the performance science in action with the students. And I assume you're gathering students are being gathered for you in the background. I don't know anything about that, but
correct. Nor do I yet. So I'm excited. Part of the fun is being able to sort of bring whatever skill sets I can to kind of almost the unknown. And then I am learning in real time. I'm learning about that student in real time. I'm learning about their playing in real time. and learning about that weird tension that they have in their right forearm and thinking about ways that we can fix that. And what is it about the physiology of the hand that might be just impacting that in everyone?
And like you said, so many of these things we don't necessarily think about, or we may be subconsciously aware of, but aren't able to put labels on them and understand the concepts like the ones you've just described.
That's the important thing. Is there are so many students that come to me and will say, I've got a weak fourth finger. And many teachers I know will hand them an exercise book and say, just play through some Czerny and it'll get better.
Right.
That's fine. And it might. But you have to understand that your third and fourth finger, as we label them in keyboard playing, share a tendon.
Yeah.
Which is why that fourth finger is weak. And there's a little example. It's impossible to do via audio only, but there's an example of demonstrating how your fingers can be sort of made inoperable if you move them in a certain way.
Yeah, well, I'm in my fourth finger now, and I can't move it past pretty much level there. I just physically can't do it if I move other fingers. Anyway, that's the tendon crossing there. So, well, I personally look forward to seeing that learning how to learn in action at the masterclass. Again, that's Saturday, July. Well, see, it begins with a J. January 15th in the morning. I'm not sure the exact time. I think 10. We'll put that on the website or in the show notes. At Herrick Chapel at Occidental College on the Schlicker organ with Tyrone Whiting, who we're talking to here. And then his recital on Monday evening, January the 17th. Talk about a little bit about the focus of the masterclass. You've picked what I was reading, certain types of music, pre-1750 and symphonic and romantic French music. Is that, do you have a particular interest in those, or is it because the organ and the acoustic are sort of right for those?
I think that's one of the wonderful things about being an organist. No matter how much you read a specification, no matter how much you listen to a recording, you're never quite sure what that organ's going to do and how you're going to use it when you sit down at it. You can give a good guess and you can prepare as much as you can, but you're never going to know until you're in the space. I've chosen those two areas because they fascinate me. We obviously have Bach, and there's this arbitrary 1750 cutoff date for this earlier music, which I don't agree with, but we're going to stick with it for now.
it's the standard that's been established, so we'll sort of grudgingly go along.
It's a very useful date. But there's so much going on, from the French classical tradition, as it's titled, to the English voluntary, to early German works, and early Iberian works. And as that travels to Latin America, I spent some time in Mexico, actually, with my husband, who leads art study tours there, exploring some of the organs there and some of the music traditions. It's fascinating, but not enough people know about it. And so I'm a big advocate for exploring outside the usual box, even if it's within this sort of 1750 date cutoff. And then the French symphonic repertoire just always spoke to me. Always spoke to me. I've been very fortunate to study with some excellent teachers, including David Graham and Sophie Veronique at the Royal College of Music. Sophie Veronique and I had lessons together at Saint-Sulpice in Paris, and I've played at Le Mans Cathedral, Say Cathedral, and various venues in France. And there's just something about that repertoire that that really speaks to me. And for this year coming, Franck will just, it's going to be my 2022, because I adore his music. Everything from his orchestral stuff to his solo piano works. I'm currently looking through the Prelude, Chorale, and Fugue for the piano, which is much more difficult than anything he ever wrote for the organ.
Yeah. A pandemic project of mine was to read the book by R.J. Stove. Have you read that? I can't remember. It's César Franck, Life and Time, something like that.
Huh.
I want to say it's a few years old, but it was new to me. And there's a lot of detail and it's kind of dense on the history, but I took a lot away from it in terms of the impact Franck had and how he was perceived at the time he was writing and how he's perceived now. And this, of course, the 200th anniversary of his birth. What about his music speaks to you? What does it say?
There's something, it's fascinating, because I think he is so able to develop a melodic idea. If it's sad.
That's part of the takeaway from the book, I think, is he was kind of a, and maybe it was his personality. He seemed like he was an introvert.
To some extent, I think he gets a bad rap because especially the image used on a typical Dover publication of his complete works puts him as this older man sitting at the organ looking very austere and
crouched over.
Exactly right. But I think his more triumphal moments, I'm thinking of things like the ending of the Grand Pièce Symphonique, are almost an embarrassed happiness. And that for me is just really interesting. He puts us through, this work is featuring in the recital on the 17th of January, which is why it's at the forefront of my mind. He puts us through the mill with so many different sections, not quite movements, but sections of music and mood and texture, registrations. There are some of the most bizarre registrations in that piece. And I love them. I think they're great. And then suddenly we're just done. the sort of triumph of the F sharp major at the end, after you've had this horrendous pedal exercise to get through with these huge chords. And it's just like, oh, okay.
Hope you liked it.
But I think that does speak to France at the time, that the kind of idea of composition in France at the time. I also think it's, I do agree with myself there, I think. It also does lend itself, I think the Grand Pièce Symphonique is such a wonderful example of Franck holistically. It contains some of his orchestral style. It contains his solo pianistic works. There's one part of it that's really reminiscent of the A major sonata for violin and piano. They might be the other way around. I forget which one's composed first. But it's such a great work in terms of demonstrating what was possible at the time. And I feel like this is why I'm a bit obsessed with this turn of this century France. Everyone's trying to show what is possible. This is why we have world's fairs and earlier world's fairs where swell shutters draw crowds because holy hell, they're new.
right.
Exactly right. The 1899 exhibition in Paris, and it's just a fascinating time. And so Franck's really trying to progress his world. And it works because we end up very quickly with the likes of Messiaen and Tournemire. That is a very quick transition from Franck dying in late 19th century to what happens at the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, it seemed like
it's a really interesting. Sorry,
I was going to say it seemed like the later French composers you mentioned were also trying to figure out what's possible, but they stood on Franck and people who came slightly after him to do that.
Absolutely right. I think it's a when you put it. This is again why I'm obsessed with learning. I was a kid that took stuff apart. I had to know how stuff worked. Like, how does the toaster pop up? Why does it know how to pop up? How does the printer work? Yeah. It's exactly the same with the music. You cannot understand how to play Franck's works or any composer's works if you haven't experienced the emotions that they're trying to convey. You could be the best pianist in the world. Unless you've experienced loneliness, you cannot play the second movement of Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto. You just cannot do it. You have to have experienced loneliness to be able to play it. And my piano teacher, actually, in my undergraduate, Philip Folk, wonderful, wonderful man, recently got an honorary fellowship for the Trinity College London and used to play all BBC proms. He was one of these advocates. He was, if you're spending too much time in a practice room, you're not learning enough about life.
Yeah.
And he used to take his students to the pub and we would sit and we would talk about music, but over a beer. That's the benefit of having an 18-year-old drinking age in the UK. But this is the way we, if we approach music like this and we understand what's going on in Franck's life at a time, what's going on in Paris at a time, what's going on in Europe at this time, it's a much more interesting way of discovering history and music. I never teach musical history linearly. I'd rather pick when each country had a civil war, bring those years in line and say, okay, what's happening musically during a civil war? That's a much more interesting comparison than, oh, in 1912 this happened, and then 1964 we have this. It doesn't work.
Yeah, and as someone who trained as an actor, I mean, it's the same thing. Being involved in life and understanding, you know, how you're going to bring a character to life will, you know, you need to understand, not just intellectually, but kinesthetically and in every other way, psychologically, what's going on there. So you can help bring that to life, and you just turn it to music. And it's the same thing. If you're going to channel the emotions of a particular piece, you need to be able to tap into that. I had another thought in my mind, but I'll get to it in a second, which is kind of random. But what else are you planning for the recital on the 17th?
I want to try and demonstrate the idea that the repertoire that I'm asking the students to prepare for the masterclass. I feel it's only fair that I prepare the same sort of things.
There you go.
So some early English organ voluntaries. Well, there'll be some Bach in there, of course. Some Gilmour, but lesser known Gilmour. I think he's a well-respected composer, and people know him and enjoy his works. But there's more out there than Symphony 1 or Symphony 8, although it'll probably be a movement from Symphony 1, who knows. And then this Franck Grand Pierre Symphonique, which I might pair with another Franck work. And then sort of some curveballs in the middle to sort of really complement the program, hopefully.
Okay, curveball. We'll keep those secret. You've got to come to hear what they are.
That way, I don't have to commit.
There you go. You've still got a few weeks out to sort of refine what the rep's going to be. Monday evening, January 17th, 8 p.m., Tyrone Whiting in recital at Herrick Chapel at Occidental College on the Schlicker organ there. Looking forward to that. The random thought I was thinking about a minute ago, and you brought up you're going to play some Bach on the 17th. Back to learning what's possible. It's kind of a random thought, but I always wondered, would Bach have written the music he wrote if he'd had a Cavaillé-Coll, for example, organ to play on? Or would he have written something, stuff totally different? Or both? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? He didn't know any better, so he wrote the music he wrote because, at least the organ music I'm talking about, because those were the instruments he knew. If he'd had something else, an orchestral instrument, would he have gone, oh my, I don't know. That's my random thought for the day. Do you have any thoughts on that, or is it just sort of?
I think that's a fascinating question. I think the instrument does a lot for pushing forward music as much as the performer might. But then I'm thinking of the likes of Paganini, who by modern day standards would have been a sort of mediocre to good violinist. If we're to believe sort of accounts of his playing. I mean, he was clearly a good violinist, but the technical advancements players have made since, it's just beyond comparison. In respect to Bach, I think so. I think we wouldn't see all toes if Bach didn't have short pedal boards. It was just impossible to play with heels on some of the organs. And the same goes for the French classical repertoire. So I think we would have seen a different side of Bach, or we would have seen more of a crossover between his compositions. There are some melodies that he writes that are belong in sort of Lieder, but they don't, because we treat them like his chorales, or we treat them like his fugues. And that can be a real shame. Don't tie over a bar line. Well, you can't play some movements of the trio sonatas then, because you have to. Otherwise, it makes no musical sense. And when I say have to, I feel compelled not to, or to do so.
Right.
And the one thing about Bach that I always go back to is, as much as we give him the credit he's due, he didn't like the piano. And we know he didn't like the piano. And so even a genius, in inverted commas, can be wrong once.
And I know some people who they say, you know, Bach, he's good, not my favorite, you know. And people go, "What? That's blasphemy! You can't say that."
I quite agree. I think there are Bach works that aren't as good as the others. I also think there are works that need more prominence to give us context about the composer. He writes a cantata for coffee. That should be 101 fact about Bach. Here's something more interesting than Toccata and Fugue in D minor, and that might keep you hooked.
My husband Greg. He listens to a lot more classical music than I do, but and there's the radio station here. Sorry, KUSC, I'm calling you out. He complains that they play the same old stuff all the time. It's Bach, it's Beethoven, it's Haydn, you know, Brahms. They're not intrinsically bad. It's just there's so much more there, and so many other composers that were overshadowed by these, the giants of the classical music world that you've never heard of. And their music, when it sneaks out, you go, wow, that's really good. Why don't we hear that enough? I don't know.
I think it's it kind of goes back to the beginning of the conversation when we started, where it's about programming and it's about allowing space for new creation and new music. I love working in the church world because I can guarantee that when I put a new hymn down, and it might not be a new hymn at all, but it might be an unknown hymn, I'll have someone in the congregation come up to me and say, well, it's wonderful, but it's no Ralph Vaughan Williams, is it? And it's so my answer to that is always, and I've had this in congregations across continents, in the UK, in France, in the US, the answer to that is everything was new once. So why do some things exist still?
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to that question. I wish I did.
Yeah, I don't either. It's sort of a rhetorical. I wonder, you know, why does those poor composers whose music never really saw the light of day, who were fabulous, who maybe, you know, 1,000 years from now will find some old manuscripts buried somewhere and we go, wow, we missed out on a lot of good stuff. They missed out on a lot of good stuff way back then.
And we're still discovering stuff. We're still discovering pieces by well-known composers. I think the most recent organ-related revelation was Mendelssohn's Allegro Chorale and Fugue, which was only discovered in 1987.
Wow.
It's a wonderful, wonderful piece of music, but it was such a late discovery.
Yeah. Well, another example of the more you learn, the more you realize how much you don't know, right?
Correct. And it's terrifying.
Yes, it is. It's like, you'll never know everything, but I guess you have to pick and choose what's important to you. And obviously teaching is important to you. And we look forward to your masterclass, January 15th, Saturday at Herrick Chapel at Occidental College. And your recital, of course, on Monday the 17th at 8 p.m. More details in your LAAGO newsletter. What else, because I don't know what I don't know, what else should I ask you? Is there anything you want to share that I haven't asked? Oh, God, I wish you'd asked that question.
Yeah, no, I think I have an abundance of need to share enthusiasm for what I do. And that's not always done through fugue analysis or picking apart someone's registration or talking about the wind pressure of an organ. All of those things are interesting in either the right amounts or the right context.
Yeah.
But things like a Bach writing a coffee cantata, Mozart writing filthy, filthy songs, much, much more interesting.
Yes.
And give context to the human being that's behind this music. Too often, unless we're playing living composers' music, we forget that this person was once living.
Was a person.
Yes, absolutely. They had a life. We seem to be centering around Bach, but to thinking about Bach working in a boarding school surrounded by his multiple children whilst pumping out a cantata a week, if not a day, is just mind-boggling. It's amazing what can happen when you don't have Facebook.
Scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. Yeah, well, yeah, context, like you said, context is important. I mean, this stuff doesn't just pop out of their heads. I mean, any composer, as some probably were, some compositions came out pretty easily and others struggled and for years to sort of pull it together and create this thing that we now, this great work of art, but it didn't just roll off a printing press.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think students need to continually ask why. And the practicing professional musicians need to be continually asking why. Actually, I just spoke about this for another little piece I wrote. As soon as someone tells me they don't like a piece of music, I need to know why. I don't care if you don't. I could get off the organ bench and you freshly tell me that you hated every 30 minutes, every bit of the 30 minutes I just played. Mm-hmm. That's fine, but why? And that just allows me some insight to your understanding, but also I might learn something. I had a wonderful man come up to me once. I was playing the third chorale of Franck. The first chorale of Franck, and I finished and there was this nice applause and I was, oh, that's lovely. And I was waiting at the door, seeing everyone out. And he came up to me and said, I was utterly disappointed to hear you not use the Vox Humana. To which my reply was, well, if you wish to fund one for this organ to have one, that would be wonderful. But sadly, there was not one for me to use.
Yeah, we work with what we've got.
Yes, exactly right. And I think often we forget that an organ is such a piece of machinery that it may not have everything you need. Not everything on that organ is going to be working. And that context of good days and bad days. I have so many students who have come up to me before and said, I just can't play today.
Really?
And you have to do that route of why. And it might be some personal drama as an undergraduate, which we all went through, and it's horrendous. Every drama is the biggest thing ever. Or it might be that they knock their elbow at a party and actually can't move, but they haven't really worked that out yet.
The lesson there is life happens, and sometimes you have a deadline. You go to church service, you're going to play in half an hour. And if you've got some drama in your life going on here, you need to drop that for a while, do your job, and then get on with it. Then you can get back to your pity party.
That's it. And I think it's so important. I wish someone had told me earlier in my musical training that it was okay to make a mistake. Because I think I would have made fewer mistakes. I was so wrapped up in it not being okay that the mistakes happened. Mm-hmm. But if I was allowed that sort of creative freedom earlier on in my training, I probably wouldn't have made so many.
I can totally see that for myself, especially, you know, the obsession over, I don't call it an obsession or not, but the desire to play well, what does that mean? We want to play well, but if it means you cannot miss a note or there can be absolutely, you know, everything has to be perfect, what does that mean? And isn't that kind of a rather terrifying standard to hold yourself to? If you have to play perfectly every time you lay your hands on whatever keyboard or any instrument, that's like, you're not a machine. The organ's a machine. You're a person. And I have heard many, many fine, fine organists go up on a piece or push a wrong piston or hit a wrong note. And you know what? They're good enough. You just plow on through and we love it at the end.
That's it. I just played at Princeton University Chapel a few weeks ago, beginning of December. And I was playing the little yon toccatina that everyone knows as a sort of palate cleanser between two bigger pieces. And my registration wasn't correct. And I was just like, this is not what I set. So I'm looking at the beginning of the page where it's got the numbers written, which piston, which channels I should be on. It's correct. And I'm like, this is still not what I set. And I'm going through and thinking about everything except the fact that I hadn't close the crescendo box all the way. And it's just irritating, but it was just a fact. I had on extra flutes that I didn't need because I hadn't bothered to check. Did anyone really care?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Did anyone notice the slightly dodgy registration? Maybe. Did anyone die? No.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. Being allowed to be creative, being allowed to improvise. I've just ordered a book which is on the forgotten history of piano improvisation, which I'm really excited to read because I think that's so important for us to do as any musician, to be able to improvise.
Do you do a lot of formal improvising yourself?
Often. Preludes and postludes at church are often considered structured improvisations. Again, something I learned much of from Sophie Veronique and Saint-Sulpice.
I'm not familiar with the structured, you know, how an improvisation is supposed to go. There's got to be a structure somehow, or it just goes on forever and ever and ever, which I guess would be a rambling improvisation. When I do that, it's a good way to just let go, don't you think? Just sort of, and it's slightly terrifying when you're just, I'm just going to start something. You know, I know generally we're the kind of mood is going to be in and see what happens. Because I tend to be someone who can like to have the structure and the order, you know, to prepare for it. So I know what's coming. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's a exercise I need to sort of revisit for myself more often.
The interesting thing there is that you can reverse it and make that about sight reading. You're going to start something. You have no idea what's coming up, but you are given some guidelines. So I'm going to allow myself the creative freedom to create music out of these guidelines that I'm about to be given, which are the notes and dynamics and whatever else. And there's actually a really wonderful chapter that compares the sort of psychology between improvisation and sight reading in a book called Musical Excellence. Musical Excellence is a kind of go-to base level music psychology book for me. It's by one of my professors from the college, Aaron Williamman.
Wonderful. Tyrone Whiting is who we're talking with. Tyrone is doing a recital at Herrick Chapel on the campus of Occidental College on Monday evening, January 17th at 8 p.m. And we'll be doing a masterclass also at Herrick Chapel on Saturday, January 15th. That is just a couple weeks away. Tick tock, tick tock. Tyrone, this has been great. I've enjoyed meeting you, even if it is remotely. We can see each other through this system we're using now. I look forward to your arrival here in LA. We all do. And I look forward to meeting you in person.
Likewise. I'm really excited. It's going to be a really, really fun week. And I'm looking forward to meeting yourself and Kevin Cartwright from the LA AGO, who sort of booked me for this gig. So I'm really looking forward to it.
The LA AGO podcast is produced by the Los Angeles chapter of the American Guild of Organists. You can listen to every episode on the chapter website at laago.org or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have a comment or want to send us some feedback, use the contact form on the podcast page. And if you want to renew your membership or find out more about becoming a new member, you'll find all the details at laago.org/membership. Finally, make sure to check out the LA chapter's YouTube channel and Facebook page. Our thanks to Carson Kuman for letting us use his performance of late longtime chapter member Wilbur Held's Air as our theme music. I'm Thompson Howell. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.